This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield, so he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Today's show is brought to you by ZipRecruiter, which is the presenting sponsor of Recode Decode. You know what's not smart? Taking selfies while you're driving. You know what is smart? Hiring with ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's powerful technology finds people with the right experience for your job and actively invites them to apply so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. based on Trustpilot rating of hiring sites with over 1,000 reviews. Now our listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/decode. That's ZipRecruiter.com/decode. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's show is brought to you by GoCD, the open source continuous delivery tool from ThoughtWorks. Modeling and visualizing your entire path to production in a single view, GoCD allows you to troubleshoot a broken pipeline by tracking every change in real time. GoCD supports popular cloud environments such as Kubernetes, Docker, AWS, and more. Release software faster, safer, and more reliably with GoCD. Download and use GoCD for free at gocd.org. Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as someone who will hold a grudge against you if you skip voting in the midterm elections, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is Steve Hilton, the co-founder and former CEO of CrowdPack. He's been on the show before talking about that. He's also the host of a show on Fox News called The Next Revolution and the author of a new book. Steve, welcome to Recode Decode.
Great to be back.
I'm going to let you say the title of this book because it makes me laugh.
What's wrong with it?
Did you promise to burst out laughing like they did at the UN when
President Trump came
back? That was the appropriate response.
Okay. The new book is called Positive Populism.
Yes, I know. That makes me
revolutionary ideas. Revolutionary ideas to rebuild economic security, family, and community in America.
Positive populism.
Yes.
All right. Before we get to it, let's explain who, what CrowdPack. What I want to. You are a British political hack, essentially.
You worked
several different people, and then
you forgot to mention my restaurant that I started and ran. That was very nice. My corporate social responsibility consulting firm.
I don't care about that. We talked about that before. What I care about. So anyway, so since we
talked, also the Hungarian part. I always got to get that.
Since we talked, you were running CrowdPack. Explain CrowdPack for the people.
So CrowdPack is a crowdfunding site for politics, and the idea behind it was to make it easier for candidates, independent candidates and independent-minded candidates of all parties and none, to run for office without relying on the traditional big donors and the party machines, so that when they get elected, they wouldn't be dependent on anyone other than their constituents.
Like an IndieWire for...
Well, yeah, and just to sort of enable small donors. Small donors obviously have had a great success. You know, Obama had great success with small donors. Bernie Sanders, that's great for those big presidential campaigns. The idea was to bring that energy and dynamism of the small donor movement to every race, not just federal, but state and local as well.
And Florida, he did that. Andrew Gillum did that. A lot of people. Different candidates have different success with that.
Exactly. So we were a platform to enable that. And we started out very strongly of the view that we ought to be a non-partisan platform. That was our kind of position. And when we last spoke, that's what CrowdPack was. Right at the beginning, actually, everyone said to me, that's crazy. That's not how politics works in America. You're going to have to pick a side. You won't be able to make the non-partisan thing work because there'll be suspicion of you on both sides. And that basically turned out to be true. So I'm pleased to say that CrowdPack has done really well in this cycle particularly. But as you could predict, the energy in terms of small donors and people running for office and the kind of independent-minded person running for office, the person who's not a political hack, who hasn't done it before, that's basically all been on the left.
Right.
And so we looked at the data and basically followed the user. And it turned out that, I think the last time I saw the numbers when I basically stepped down as CEO earlier in the year, I think it was 87% of the candidates on CrowdPEC were Democrats.
So you were running a Democratic organization.
Right, and more than, and like 94% of the dollars raised were on the left.
On the left.
And so it just increasingly was untenable for me to be heading up
right.
that organization.
Because you're not increasingly on the left.
Exactly.
Right.
And so we made a strategic
untenable.
Decision.
What did they just say, get this?
No,
I
initiated the process because it was clear that actually CrowdPEC's success was being held back by the fact that the CEO, me, was identified as being on the right. And I think that and so we went through I initiated a process. We talked to the senior management and the board and said, look, I think it makes sense
where
for us to
where does something like that
change.
Go? Just create partisan fundraising organization? What happens?
Well, that's certainly what CrowdPEC now is. So we took a strategic decision to officially become a progressive left-leaning organization and actually removed the small number of Republican candidates from the platform. I don't know, like a handful.
Were they sort of lefty Republicans?
They were slightly, I would say they were slightly more the sort of crazy side of Republicans.
Okay, all right,
now,
okay.
I know you might challenge that term as being applying only to a small group.
No, but I do challenge that right these days. Everyone has a chance to go crazy for a while. But so you left that. What was the success? How do you look at it as a success? Because you also wanted to be an information vehicle.
Yeah, that was an initial, I think typical kind of tech mistake, frankly, I think, looking back on it, but you learn from them, was that I think we wanted to do too many things. We didn't have sufficient focus. So originally, the initial idea, the very first idea that I pitched to investors when I was doing the rounds was this very focused crowdfunding platform. I literally, my sort of stupid elevator pitch line was Kickstarter for politics.
Right.
That was the phrase that
Indiegogo.
I used. Very much focused on the crowdfunding. And then as time went on and I met my co-founder, Adam Boniker, who's a very impressive professor at Stanford of political science, who's really done a lot of brilliant work on data and analyzing campaign finance data and what that can tell you about candidates and so on. We built out this whole data model and we thought, well, that's really great because we won't just enable people to give money and candidates to raise money. We can also provide objective information about elections. So we become a broader platform. And this is what we use this phrase, platform for political participation, raising money, running for office, and voting.
Right. So giving out information.
So we spent a lot of time building out voter guides and profiles of candidates and races and so on. And in the end, that was a distraction, frankly, for our team from the core work that we initially, that was my initial plan, and in the end was the thing that really took off. And secondly, it was just from a business point of view, not obvious how we would monetize that in a way that wouldn't compromise the integrity of the information and make people suspicious of it. And so in the end, we decided to drop all of that. And it was exactly when we made that focus that things really started to take off.
And it's still raising money. And
yeah,
who's running
absolutely.
It? Who's the CEO?
My co-founder, Giselle Cordestani.
Is running it. And so what's your affiliation with it now?
Well, I'm literally, I'm not on the board. I came off the board and I'm not in the management and I just don't have any contact with
it. So, because then you went over to Fox and have this new show.
Well, we did it in parallel. The show's now about a year old. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But what I mean is this increasing, I want to get to your book in the next section, but the increasing politicalization of things. Talk about that because, you're leaving a job because of that. Did people complain?
There was a bit of that.
Right.
But it wasn't just that. It was also things like, actually, funnily enough, even the designation nonpartisan was a barrier.
It sounds so much better in British. Partisan.
Yeah, okay. Maybe that was the problem.
Sounds
everyone
like
should
cheese.
Have said it with a British accent.
The
conduct potential,
our whole lives in a British accent.
You know, one of the things we're trying to do is to build partnerships with organizing groups, people who are helping candidates run for office and so on and present our tools.
There's lots of them.
Exactly. And some of them we established very good relationships with. And a good example, I think, is Sister District, for example, very strong working partnership, even when I was there. But there are others who just said, look, I'm sorry, we just don't want to work with a nonpartisan platform. We're Democrats and we want to work in an ecosystem that's entirely
Democrat.
And so that was happening anyway.
Yeah, and then when you target those kids,
and so it's not as if voters. My, and then my increasing prominence, I was on TV and whatever, and therefore I'd always been openly a conservative, if you like. Although actually I don't really like that label either. So we'll get to positive populism in a minute. But it was never a secret.
We walk around like a conservative.
And that's
heard
right.
You can't do that in Silicon Valley.
It's very, very dangerous.
No, but it's not.
I'm joking. God. I'm joking. And then the thing is that it wasn't as if we were getting, CrowdPAC was getting a compensating increase in traction amongst Republicans because I was increasingly well known. That wasn't happening either.
Right.
So we weren't getting any benefit
from
me being on TV, as it were, and identified on the Republican side. But it was holding us back. And so I just thought, well, what is the point of this? It makes more sense just to
be progressive.
And also just to, you know,
just
make
go where your customers are.
Exactly right, to catch up with the reality. And then once you make that decision that we're officially a left-leaning platform, it just makes no sense for me to be running that.
Right. And so you leave and you started this show. This show on Fox News called The Next Level. Explain that also for people because I want them to get a context.
It's Sunday nights at 9 Eastern. Mm-hmm. We do it live. We do it live!
Right.
Someone
I've been there. I've been on your show.
from LA, although once a month from New York or DC. And it's an opinion show. Mm-hmm. It does have a theme which comes really from my prejudices, I guess, which I say every week, this is the home of positive populism. The book title came from what I say every Sunday. And so what I'm trying to do on the show is make an argument for exactly that, for a populist policy agenda that isn't all about being angry and yelling and screaming and complaining about things. Rather, it's about saying, okay, how do we solve the problems that have given rise to populist phenomena like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or Brexit or whatever? So that's the idea. And we do it every Sunday. And one of the things I think that's really distinctive about it that we did on the very first show and has really taken off is this segment we do every week called Swamp Watch, which I love and has a great response, where we actually dive into the anatomy of this phrase everyone now uses, the swamp. We're sitting in it in DC as we're talking. And the connections between big money and the corporate interests and the donations and the lobbying and the revolving door between Congress and the private sector and the way that all ends up influencing policy. And we do a lot of good work, I think, exposing that. And by the way, we do it in a very independent-minded way. So I've gone after Wilbur Ross and Scott Pruitt and Steve Mnuchin and Ted Cruz most recently.
Oh, that's
so
easy.
Well,
that's
but on the connections between, you know, for example, it's just like
it's real low-hanging fruit. I agree with you. You're right. Yeah.
You know, the way that, you know, you serve on a committee
and
you regulate, I don't know, the transportation industry and then you get a ton of money from transportation interests.
Right. And so you take those on. You've taken on a lot of like issues. You went after a whole bunch of things that I was surprised at. So being on
I don't want to give the wrong impression, however. I mean, that's just to make sure our listeners understand that I do try and be independent. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, it's not like I'm sort of importing a bit of MSNBC into Fox.
Right,
I don't want to give people
so
that
you're not
impression.
Rachel Maddow of Fox News. Well, a little bit.
Well, I like to think that we go deeper into the kind of, because my background is in policy and government, I like to think that we go a bit deeper into some of the issues and explain why this is
instead
happening.
Of a scream fest, sort of the regular scream fest on both a rage or bag of rage, which is what I call Sean Hannity, but you don't have to call him that.
I certainly wouldn't, my dear colleague and friend.
In any case, but that's the show. That's the show is mad, and yours is more like let's look at each of these policies.
The other thing is,
you're a little mad on the show. Like all of them have.
No, right? I I don't want to pretend it's something it's not. But I also would like. I think one other dimension to it.
Much smarter show. The only reason I agreed to go on.
Well, thank you. I think that the other thing I would say is there's something about that your tone, one's tone. I try and do it at least with a smile on my face. You know, literally, but also figuratively, in the sense of trying to be positive about all this craziness that's going on and trying to direct it towards solutions.
But it's degenerate. I mean, the way it's done is, one, it's partially entertainment to do this, to create those panels of people screaming at each other. And and it's cheap, by the way. It's a really inexpensive way to do it. And it's not smart or substantive or solution-based. They're all the same in that way because they're not trying to look for solutions. They're trying to, you know, are we not entertained? It's like the gladiators. And I think taking on big topics, that used to be like you would be more in the William Safire school, like considered conservative opinions that are then expressed in an intelligent way.
Yeah, and also the other thing I like doing is having people on who've written interesting books, whether mm-hmm. they're from the right or left or no particular political place, just looking mm-hmm. at an issue. And occasionally topics that I feel strongly about that you just wouldn't expect to see on Cape and Zero. A good example was, it's actually my wife first pointed it out to me, but we were both just really horrified. There's an amazing story by a New York Times reporter a couple of months ago on the trade in apes, mm-hmm. and, you know, and just mm-hmm. it was one of those brilliant pieces of reporting, put it on the front page and just lengthy reporting, and you just read every word. I read every word of it and thought, this is so good and awful, but such a good report, and mm-hmm. let's have him on to talk about it. And it was interesting because actually the audience responded really well to that, and you might have thought, well, that's not the sort of thing, and it's animal welfare, and who cares about that? Turns out a lot of people do.
Of course, but they get a steady diet of anger. Like, in all the, on both sides, it's a steady diet of exactly. I mean, literally, the other night, my mom said something, and then I went and looked on Fox News, and that's just what they had said. And I was like, oh my God, she's been near the television, or something like that. It was really interesting. She does that all the time. So it's an ability to think on your own about issues is getting harder. So your show is much like that. So you do this weekly, mm-hmm. And then it started this from this was this idea of positive populism. So why don't you start going into that, and we'll talk more about it in the next segment. What is, how do you describe that? Give me a quick definition, and we'll get to it.
I think the reality is that word populism. I know it's been around for a long time, but it's been kind of revived in the last few years and applied to these various political phenomena.
On many sides.
Brexit, right. Trump, Bernie Sanders on the left as well, not just exclusively on the right. But I think the one, if you ask people, what is populism? I think that the to the extent that anyone has any, you know, thing to say about it, they would say, well, it's, you know, it's angry, you know, it's against things. It's against the elites. It's
right.
against,
yes.
I don't know, uncontrolled immigration. It's against big business or trade deals or whatever. It's always what it's against.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, as I argue in the book, there's a lot of good reasons for people to be angry with some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to do was say, okay, fine, you're angry. But how are we going to solve that? And there's a line I use, which, you know, is a bit pat, but I say anger without an agenda just leads to further rage and frustration and mm-hmm. actually self-pity. And so you've got to turn that anger into something constructive. And that's really the point of positive populism is like, okay, what are we for? Not just what are we against? What is populism for? What's it in favor of? What's it arguing for?
So how would you define populism? When we get back in the next section, I want you to talk about sort of more specifics.
Say there's four things. And I'm going to say them, and you're going to say, well, that's a platitude, and I'm going to explain why it's not. So the first thing is that I think it's not particularly ideological. That's why I'm now uncomfortable with labels like conservative or mm-hmm. right, or it just doesn't feel right to me. It's not ideological. It's very practical and pragmatic, and it's defined, in my view, not by ideology, but by interests. What are the interests it's trying to advance? And to me, there are three in particular. It's pro-worker, pro-family, and pro-community.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, who's against that?
Right.
Well, if you look at the way policy's been constructed and implemented over the last few decades, not just the last, mm-hmm. this is not a partisan thing against mm-hmm. Obama or whatever, under Obama, Bush, all of them, policy has not been pro-worker. Mm-hmm. It's actually been in favor of the owners of capital
so
on. It hasn't been pro-family. By the way, when I say pro-family, I don't want people to hear that as some kind of, you know,
straight people.
No, I mean, I say very clearly in the sections on family, I totally have, and I, you know, when I worked in the British government, we introduced marriage equality, and I've always been for it. And there's an interesting argument about the way that at the same time as, I'm digressing now, but at the same time as marriage equality has advanced, and that's a great thing, marriage has retreated in the straight world. That's kind of an interesting thing.
Only gay people want to get married. Gay people want to get married and go into the military, but go ahead.
Actually, there's an interesting twist to that, which is also marriage has become a class thing. So the way I put it in the book is now marriage is for gay people and rich people.
Yeah, that was just an interesting article in the Times about this.
So I think that various things, not just policy, but have actually helped to undermine families of all kinds. And when I say pro-community, what that really means is trying to restore a sense of, I think everything's become too centralized. Mm-hmm. Power's become too concentrated,
right,
both in the economy and in government. And so dispersing power
back to the local
is a really big theme of this. So, right. And I think that would give people more sense of control over what goes on around them, and that would make them less angry.
Right, and more sense of belonging. All right, we're here talking to Steve Hilton. He's the host of The Next Revolution on Fox News. He's also the author of a new book called Popular Populism. He's explaining that. When we get back, we're going to talk about what that means in practice, because something's got to give here in this country and across the world.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where he earns 5% annual percentage yield, so he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
We're here with Steve Hilton. He's the host of The Next Revolution on Fox News, but he's also the author of a book called Popular Populism. He used to run a company in Silicon Valley called CrowdPack, which was trying to do essentially Kickstarter for funding of elections and information. He left that, and now he's focused on his show and also on this book. So let's talk more about popular populism. Popular populism.
I thought it would be even better. Anyway.
Right, positive populism. They're never paired together. So
yeah.
Why is that? Let's talk about why that's happened, because I think Donald Trump has ridden the wave of angry populism. You know, you aren't getting enough. You got screwed. The elites got you. The whole, yeah, you know.
Yeah. And not just him. Let's be fair, Bernie as well.
Yes, the same thing. Yeah. Actually,
their language was very similar. It was one of the interesting things, I think, during the 2016 campaign, 2015 and 2016, those 2 years, mm-hmm, where they were making their arguments, is there's a huge overlap between the things that they said, Bernie and Trump. Remember, Trump talked constantly about the other candidates, Bush and so on, as well as Hillary, the phrase used, they're the puppets of their donors. He talked, mm-hmm, a lot, actually.
Yes.
I mean, okay, you can say he hasn't done anything about it subsequently, but mm-hmm, in the campaign, he talked a lot about the way that big money was controlling policies,
yes,
exactly like Bernie did. There was a real alignment with them around trade and the, mm-hmm, way they talked about that. Even immigration. Yeah. I mean, Bernie had to sort of close that down to get anywhere. But with Ezra Klein, amazing, mm-hmm, interview in 2015,
right,
Bernie gave, where he was, you know, he said, open borders, that's a Koch brothers proposal. What are we going to do? Bring in all these low-wage workers? That's going to hurt African-American,
right,
kids and whatever.
Right.
Very similar arguments. So I think that is exactly, you're right, that it was always what we're against. And I think that's the problem. It's like, well, what are we going to do about
it? What else? List the other things they're against. It's like fear. It's based in fear. It's based in you're losing out. It's based in you're getting less.
You're getting screwed.
You're getting screwed, and the other guy's doing it.
Yes, that's right. And I think that.
And is that historical? That's historical, right? Well, maybe not, because I'm listening to the Andrew Jackson book, which is very complex, mm-hmm, actually, much more so than has been written about. And he's not Trump at all. He's not even, mm-hmm, I mean, he has some terrible things he did and also really interesting politician. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's throughout U.S. history and throughout history in general. I mean, you could say the French Revolution is populism. How do you look at it over time?
Yeah, and the American, actually. Revolution, I mean, yeah. I think that's right, especially its focus on, you know, again, it sounds a bit of a cliche, but that theme of people power, putting hands, mm-hmm, power in the hands of people.
It's also called mob rule, too. I mean, that's what it's been called sometimes.
Well, as long as it's dispersed. Anyway, we can get into that.
Yeah. But I want to mention the historical underpinnings.
Yeah, funnily enough, I mean, I'm not a historian. I remember when this word came up, in the last couple of years, I embraced it. Mm-hmm. If we could go back, you know, I worked, as you mentioned earlier, in politics in the UK. My first job out of college was working at the Conservative Party headquarters in the UK when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister. So for various reasons, you know, my parents are Hungarian, and I know that there's no connection directly between communism in Hungary and the Labour Party in the UK. But I found myself kind of on the right and identifying with Thatcher, partly because she had a story in the 80s that she was for the workers. By the way, that was quite interesting. She sort of changed from that anyway. So I've always kind of been on that side of the political fence, but increasingly felt that it didn't really feel comfortable. For example, when I rose through the ranks and then went and did other things and started businesses and came back when my friend David Cameron went to become the leader. And I worked with him on a policy agenda that a lot of people say, well, that's not conservative, and we were accused of betraying the principle, you know, all that stuff. And I kind of felt, yeah, actually, I mean, we didn't say that, but I just felt this label doesn't really, I think it's too ideological. It doesn't fit me.
Right.
And so when the populist word started being bandied around 2015, 2016, I thought, actually, that I like that. I didn't really know anything about its historical precedent. So I'm not really best placed to comment on that. But I think that from what I've read and seen and heard, that is right. It's always been this kind of resentment-driven.
Off with their heads.
Yeah, this resentment-driven approach.
Is that what it's like in Trump populism now? Because that's what it's fear-based almost. It's not positive.
Well, I think we just got to move beyond that.
Yeah, but how? That's come
because
on,
you're, once you're in, once you're there, you've got to actually solve the problems.
No, I think people can remain bomb throwers. I mean, you know, there's a bomb throw when you're campaigning. You know that you're a campaigner, and then you have to govern.
Yes.
But people are very comfortable in the campaign mode.
Yes,
especially this president is very
right.
Much
but I'm not. You know, I'm in the. I guess.
No, I didn't say that to you. But I'm saying that populism now is seen as Trump populism.
Okay,
at least in this country, and the same thing in other countries.
Yeah, that's what. And so, okay, that's really one of the reasons I wanted to write the book because. And there's very little. I mean, I don't know whether listeners will be pleased to hear this or not. But there's very little of Donald Trump or anything in the book. It's not really about that because my argument is long after he's gone, whether it's another 2 years or to horrify you another 6 years. Long after he's gone, you know, we're still going to have these problems because they're deep structural problems, right? About you know, and all through. The way we run the economy and society and services like education and training, able to get the economy of the future, all the stuff we often talk about. So those are really deep, long-term problems, and we're going to have some answers to them long after he's gone, whoever comes next, Democrat, Republican, whatever. And so what I really wanted to contribute to is the start of a conversation about an intellectually coherent set of ideas that would advance
the interests of the people who have been left out. Is the word, and words matter, now sullied in that way because that's how people think of it.
For sure. I would absolutely acknowledge that. I say that.
It links with nationalism.
Well, I would say, you're right, words matter. And I don't see that there's, I would say there's nothing, I think racism is one thing that's obviously not okay and needs to be strongly condemned. Again, I've done that very clearly on the show. I've tried to distinguish between racism and xenophobia, but nationalism. Well, by this, by talking about it, and but most importantly, I think what I really care about is putting these ideas out there, regardless of whether and these arguments out there, you know, whether or not these exact ideas and policies get implemented is not the point. They're to start a conversation, but really to build a movement of people, actually in all parties. I don't think this needs to be a right or left thing, who think about this and say, yeah, that's right. I can advance the interests of workers in our policy conversations and families and believe in decentralizing power. And that all adds up to a populist message and a populist approach, whether that's through the Democrats or Republicans or independents or whatever. That's what I care. It's a long-term thing.
Right. All right. So let's go through the ones you're talking. So what would be the policies to help workers?
Well, I think one of the most basic things you see is this incredible economic insecurity and anxiety that comes from not being able to live on what you earn and not having a reliable income. And there's so many different measures you can look at that through. I mean, one that I think is particularly striking, shows how long the problem's been going on, is that if you look at the 80% or so of, I think what the term is, non-managerial and non-supervisory workers. So And actually, I think that 80-20 thing, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it kind of works in this setting. When I talk about the elites and so on, and of course, I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are.
And I try and distinguish between...
More elite than I am, do you know that?
Of course. Yes. And I totally acknowledge that. And like, there's a difference between the elites mm-hmm. and elitism, which right. is a set of policies that help the elite.
Right. And so you're like a nice elite.
Well, I'm a sort of traitor to my elite class because I'm trying to help the workers, I guess. Anyway, the thing is that I think it's not the 1%. That's mm-hmm. the point I was going to make that we always hear about. It's more mm-hmm. like the top 20%. That's right. sort of. There's a brilliant, brilliant piece in the Atlantic cover story a couple of months ago that the author talked about the 9.9%, not the 99%, as being the real, and this notion of the inherited meritocracy, people who've got there on their own merits and have risen through the ranks of education and hard work, and now kind of have captured those benefits and people are left behind. So this data point I was going to give you, 80% or so of non-managerial, non-supervisory workers, if you take inflation into account, mm-hmm. the way their incomes have been flat since 1972.
Yes.
This is not just like the last, you know, the Great Recession.
I was just talking about this the other day.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. There's been this huge disconnect that used mm-hmm. to be there between economic growth, productivity in the economy, and incomes, where they all went up together roughly. Mm-hmm. And around the early 70s, that relationship just broke.
Right.
And suddenly the workers' pay was flat, but everyone else went, the economy still mm-hmm. grew and whatever. Mm-hmm. So, and there's lots of other measures too, and the change in the labor market.
The policies for that one.
Well, the number one thing I think is to assert a principle, which is if you work full time, you should be able to live on what you earn. Mm-hmm. At the moment, there are tens of millions, probably more. I haven't looked at the exact data. Who do work full time and can't live on what they earn?
So earned income tax credits.
Because they get all these subsidies of various kinds from the mm-hmm. from the government. Exactly, tax credits and food stamps and so mm-hmm. on. And of course, those things are vital because you couldn't live without them. But my argument is, you should get that from your employer,
right.
not from the government or another source.
Yeah, that's a hard sell, Steve.
Okay. And so my salute, the idea in the book is what I call the business-friendly living wage. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, actually. It may sort of highlight an area for compromise. So Ro Khanna mm-hmm. From yep. Silicon Valley, where I'm based, and Bernie mm-hmm. just introduced a bill the other week, I think it was, called the Stop Bezos Act. And the Bezos thing was some kind of acronym. Mm-hmm. And they made the point, which I 100% agree with, which is this phenomenon is basically a subsidy to corporate America. Mm-hmm. So they pay their workers too little for them to live on, and the government tops up their pay. So they can get away with mm-hmm. low wages.
Right.
But at the same time, there's another bit of the equation, which is the government takes money from the companies in the form of taxation, corporate taxes and payroll mm-hmm. taxes. So my argument is let's raise the minimum wage to the level of the living wage,
right.
which varies from place to place, depending mm-hmm. on housing costs and transportation costs, but make sure that you can live on what you earn. You really can, right? Mm-hmm. That's going to be a very high in right. some places, mm-hmm. like way higher than the minimum wage.
Right.
But at the same time, let's cut their corporate or payroll taxes or both right. or some combination so that the net impact on the bottom line is neutral, so that what they don't do, which is also counterproductive, is have to lay off workers because they're more expensive or replace them with right. automation. Now, the Stop Bezos bill, the Bernie Sanders-Ro Khanna thing, addresses the exact same problem, but through what I would say is a worse solution, which is to take the amount of the subsidy and tax them more.
Right.
So that's just increasing the tax, which I don't think is a particularly helpful thing. But right. it shows that we're on the same ground. You know, there's a lot of shared ground.
But doing minimum wage is so controversial. It's the same thing. They consider it taxing. That's the same thing, you know.
Yeah, but someone's got to pay. I mean, of course, then there are other things
yeah.
like why is housing so expensive in the first place? And there's a lot of argument there. I had sort of spat with, I was on Bill Maher last week and I made the point that zoning regulations are a huge factor in mm-hmm. housing being so expensive, which is true because there's not mm-hmm. enough being built. And one of the reasons there's right. not enough being built is because right. the zoning regulations
yeah.
favor the people who already have
yes.
property
yeah,
rather
they,
than those.
Yes.
Exactly. So, look, there's lots of things we can do also to reduce the cost of living mm-hmm. as well. But I think there's a basic dignity point, which is if you work full time, and by the way, a lot more people still do. I know there's this, you know, we all talk about the gig economy and mm-hmm. and so on. And there's a lot we could do there to make that fairer.
Yes, of course. That's something Gavin Newsom's been pushing, the idea that we change the way
yes.
economic incentives.
I mean, totally agree. But still, most people do still work yeah. in full-time regular jobs, actually. Mm-hmm. It's not just all disappeared
but
in favor of everyone.
Changing, though, yeah.
Yeah, but not as rapid. Anyway, look, there's a basic dignity point and a moral point, I think, there. And so that's just one idea.
Broken societies when people feel on the edge.
Exactly. And then there are other things that you could do. For example, I mean, again, this is not particularly sort of new thinking, but perhaps new from someone, on Fox News, is that you've got there are multiple ways in which the owners of businesses treat workers unfairly. A great example is non-competes, which are actually outlawed in California, but one of the reasons I think you've got such a dynamic, tech sector, you can just quickly go to a competitor and whatever. I think it's something like 18% of American workers are now covered by non-compete agreements, which is insane. These were supposed to be for those sort of genius scientists who've got...
Right, they can't walk out the door with them.
But they're being applied to people who work in fast food restaurants to stop them getting a modest pay raise by leaving McDonald's and going to Burger King. Right. It's completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
So there's lots of smaller steps as well that you can take that add up to a pro-worker policy agenda. And I think everyone should be in favor of that.
Right. All right. When we get back, we're going to talk more about the other policies that Steve is espousing. He does. You sound a little communist-y. I like it. I like this.
Oh, my God. Now I'm really in trouble.
We're here with Steve Hilton. We're talking about his new book about positive populism. Populism is now sort of a dirty word with a lot of people now, and it feels scary. Populism right now feels awfully scary. Very mob rule, nationalistic, racist, all these things that are being linked with it. And it's largely due to Donald Trump's pushing it. And in other parts of the world, we always forget other parts of the world where it's surging. It's a lot to do around immigration and issues around that too. So the second, but you were just talking about how to help the worker. The second one is how to help families. I think most people agree that this country is family anti-friendly, anti-friendly to families, essentially.
Yes.
There's no policies about maternity leave, except, say, in Silicon Valley, which has very strong ones, actually, or California. Some people think those are onerous. What other family policies? I would assume maternity leave, better
definitely,
maternity
leave. All of that. I mean, but I won't focus on those because you can basically assume I agree with all of those.
Right.
And introduced many of them as part of the British government where I worked, or they were already there in the UK anyway. I want to talk about some new things. I mean, one of the things, and just to take a step back from it, I think one of the problems in this area has been that the right, for years and years, has gone on and on about family values.
Family values, yes.
All the time,
yes.
Right? But first of all, that hasn't extended to everyone, so it's excluded non-traditional families, as it were.
We know.
Exactly. So I'm dead against that. But the other sort of practical thing is that they've not been prepared to accept or even look at any kind of active help for families. So it's all sort of lectures and preaching about families are good and we love families. But like when it comes to actually helping, it's, oh, that's nanny state, big government.
Yes, right.
So that's been a problem. But equally on the left, I think you've had a problem with a rhetoric about supporting working families with practical measures. That's great. But also a reluctance to engage in some, really kind of pretty obvious science now about the importance of family stability and so on. And I think that the answer to both is, in the end, not ideological, but practical. So I'll give you one specific example, which is that if you look at the data on when families break up, whether they're married or not, if you just look at the peak time period when typically a family that's together when one partner leaves, it's not universal, but the peak time is within the first year of the first child being born.
Right.
And it's pretty obvious why that would be.
Time.
It's incredibly tough. It's stressful. You don't get any sleep. You argue, et cetera. And so there's so much evidence now that practical help through that incredibly difficult period can help keep families together and kids growing up in a more stable home and on the right track. And there's two things I'd point to that are practical examples. First of all, in the UK, there's I should start with here. In Colorado, it started in Colorado in the 70s. There's something called the Nurse Family Partnership, which is one of the best evaluated social policy interventions in history, in the sense that the number of times it's been evaluated and shown to be successful. But it's limited to at-risk populations where you really send... And what the way it works is a trained nurse visits your home.
They do it in Louisiana. There's a whole bunch of them.
Right. And they just help with practical things, literally, getting ready for the birth and then after the birth, literally, how do I get the baby to sleep? It's driving me crazy. What feeding and all these things. And then just sort of all those kind of basic questions that is assumed that just sort of people know the answers to, and because there's millions of books and videos and online right. things, but it's not the same as someone who really knows what they're
Absolutely.
Doing that you trust coming to your house.
Positive government intervention.
Right. And they, at the moment, that is very patchy and underfunded mm-hmm. and so on. And so my proposal...
And it's not available for everybody.
No, and it's explicitly designed right now as an intervention.
Which makes sense. That's the first popular, the most...
Sure, but my proposal is, I call it universal home visiting. Mm-hmm. I think it should be available. Look, right. you don't want to force it on people if they right. really don't want it. But I think that, you know, I can't imagine a family that wouldn't benefit from it. I mean, right. you know, the most sort of... literate and well-educated and well-informed family, you know, they can't do it either.
And it's incredibly, you know, Kate Boo wrote an amazing piece, if you've ever wanted to read it, about mm-hmm. swamp nurses. And it's this, uh-huh. it's a program in Louisiana.
Oh, interesting.
It's an astonishing, it's a sad story because it's almost impossible mm-hmm. to pull some of these people out of the abject poverty and ignorance. They're, you know, yeah, right. lack of education they're in. And it's wonderful. But, you know, you sat there and you were hoping so hard that this would work because it made right. sense. It made sense.
Yeah, but the other thing I'd say is that certainly, and I spent a lot of time on this in the UK, there's a program in the UK called Health Visitors, which mm-hmm. started, I think, in the Victorian era. And I wanted to greatly expand. And the thing that is interesting is like the immediate reason for doing it is help with a new baby. Mm-hmm. And mothers are desperate for help right. with new. And so it's a good moment to
yes.
kind of establish that trusting yes, relationship
so that
with a professional.
You're getting a
benefit. But actually, what really is great is over the time, you know, the visits can get less frequent and so on, from sort of every other day to once a week to once mm-hmm. a month and so on. But actually, they become trusted to help with other things and all these other social issues that are going right. on. Maybe the partner's drinking too much, or there's a drug addiction mm-hmm. incipient problem, or just there's the health isn't that great in the family. They don't know, and or just, you know, mental illnesses, you know. And what they can do is connect them to local resources that can help and say,
right.
you know what, it feels to me like you, in a gentle way, not in a nanny way.
Well, because they would know them.
I know them. And of course, part of the program would be training those the visitors, as it were, in terms of what resources are available. And there's a whole community aspect to that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, none of this has to be the government. I mean, it needs to be funded by the government. And
right.
that's a theme throughout, because otherwise right. it's not going to happen.
Right.
You're going to make this universal by
right.
relying on charity.
And then the last one, community. And I want to sort of approach this in a way, because most people feel that communities are breaking apart, local communities mm-hmm. especially. You know, oddly, Tom Friedman, this is a big
yeah.
thing, Tom Friedman's
yeah.
in his last book, and the idea that we move things, we push things down to the communities,
yes.
which I think has been sort of mutated by ultra-conservatives about, like, all states' rights, which has been an issue
yeah.
in this country from the very beginnings of
yeah.
time. When actually it's a local is a great idea, It's just not, it's done in a way where it feels ignorant, or it feels, you know, not that the
Yeah, also local doesn't mean state. I mean,
right.
I think that there's a really, I
no,
try and sort of take, way smaller. And so I run through the kind of, the pathway of decentralization, as mm-hmm. it were. Yes, it's true that we should decentralize something from the federal level to the state level. Yes, but that doesn't
mean
stop there. Well, I think healthcare, for example, is a
right.
good example. But way further than that, from the state, I mean, you know, California, fifth biggest economy in the world. If you put all the power in Sacramento, that is hardly
right.
localization. So from the states to cities and counties, but the area I'm really interested in, and I think this is probably the freshest mm-hmm. Area in the book, is the neighborhood. I think the neighborhood is potentially an interesting area, because mm-hmm. you've got their potential human connections, because you
right.
can actually see and feel and meet people. Feel, mm-hmm. probably shouldn't use that word, but you know what I mean?
Anymore.
Touch, feel, exactly. Yeah. You can meet people and you look in there.
It's a minefield out there now.
I know. But the thing is that that's not going to happen just like that, because you tell people, oh, you should get together and do things.
Right.
People are busy there. You've got to give practical reasons for doing it and mm-hmm. a benefit. And so one starting point, it's a cliche now, and there's lots of, it's been written about a lot and replicated a lot. But years ago, one of my great friends from university, she moved here, married a guy from New York, and they've been living in Brooklyn for a long time. And
mm-hmm.
there's a place called the Park Slope Food Co-op that they took
yes.
me to, which is very well known. And the lovely thing about it is that it's a true cooperative, in the sense that you can only shop there if you are a member.
And then you work.
And you have to work.
Yeah, there's one in San Francisco.
Right, it's fantastic. And just like 2 3/4 hours a week or whatever. And there's a connection there. And what it really has made that place is a community center, because there's a reason for going, mm-hmm. right? Yes, you got to go and do your work, but you get benefits, low prices, whatever. So my question was, can we try and apply that thinking to mm-hmm. other local services? So there's a concept in the book called civic service, where let's try and think of, and there's this one idea, let's try and think of local services, could be the library or whatever, that could benefit from that kind of engagement.
Where everybody's part of it rather than being
exactly
served.
Another one is this notion, I call it compulsory community tendering, where you require, this could be a more forceful way of doing it, where you could require local government to take services that are operated mm-hmm. in the local area, either by some distant corporation or whatever, and saying we have to give the local neighborhood the chance to run this. Now, they may not want to, but maybe they
such
do.
Such as a...
Well, I don't know. I mean, whatever. It could be a health center or a clinic or I don't know. I mean, there's all mm-hmm. sorts of options. People will playground, the park.
Well, you know...
But you've got to give people reasons to get together locally
right. Well,
and benefit from doing
local
it.
Local communities, I think, is at the heart of so much.
But the other thing I'd say just about all the ideas in the book, some of which, mm-hmm. I mean, I taught for a while at Stanford, and the most transformative part of that was teaching at the D School, the design mm-hmm. school at Stanford, yeah. which, as you know, is like really about teaching the methodology right. of innovation that many of the tech firms follow in terms mm-hmm. of real focus on users and rapid prototyping and testing.
Sure.
And one of the concepts that we used at the D School that I think is a great way of capturing the status, if you like, of some of the ideas in my book is we have this notion of a sacrificial prototype, mm-hmm. which is, I know this is a stupid idea, I know it doesn't work, whatever, but I'm going to put it out there just to get the conversation going.
Sure.
Just so that it's better than just talking about something conceptually. Mm-hmm. Let's give a tangible prototype, if you like, an idea that at least it's something defined, and you can mm-hmm. rip it apart and say, well, that doesn't work and that won't work, but how about this?
Right.
And not all of the ideas in my book, but some of them are of that nature, where
right.
I'm really
You're
not...
just going to start the conversation.
Exactly. I'm really not just attached to saying, you have to implement this exactly right. as I've written it down. Right. They're not. They're ideas. They're not policies. They're there to start a conversation.
So one of the things that people feel have, you know, and let's talk a little about the tech thing, we only have a few more minutes, is this idea that tech and social media has brought down this mm-hmm. concept where people are isolated, lonely, engaged in their phones.
Yeah.
And it's true.
It is true. Yeah.
So what with the sort of the tech lash, and I'm going to mm-hmm. perhaps say your wife has worked for every tech company in America
yes.
right now, Rachel Whetstone. But separate from that, how do you look at what's happening with those, and where do you see, like, you see, you know, is it part of the policies to regulate some of this, or do you?
Oh, yeah. But it fits with another part of the argument on populism, which is the concentration of power in the economy mm-hmm. and the way businesses have got too big, not just in tech, but in every mm-hmm. sector.
Yeah.
And they've been allowed to swallow up competition and stop entrepreneurs mm-hmm. or make it much, much harder for entrepreneurs mm-hmm. to challenge them and knock them off their perch. And that story we used to tell, which is a true story about, well, look, you know, whoever, you know, Facebook knocked out MySpace and mm-hmm. Google knocked out Microsoft, and that's just, you know, these tech companies don't stay powerful for too long. Feels like that's not really true anymore, that story.
No, I think it's like a couple. Now, there used to be just one. There's always one, like, was it IBM or was it AT&T or was it Microsoft? And now there's four or three, and they're rolling down the highway like semi-trucks.
Yes.
And nobody can get around them. And they're not particularly monopolies, but they kind of are. Like, they don't, like, because they don't really compete with each other. They're not. It's really, I think they squelch innovation.
Yeah, and there's I agree.
I would say Facebook, Google, and Amazon.
And there's an interesting, so generally, my argument is we've got to really rethink our whole antitrust approach.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To be much more aggressive. At the moment, the whole approach is based on this notion of, which was really introduced by Robert Bork. I mean, mm-hmm. He's best known for the Supreme Court thing. But actually, his probably greatest policy contribution is this notion of consumer welfare. That's the phrase, which is that concentration of economic power, the size of a company, is only a problem if it hurts consumer welfare. In mm-hmm. other words, if they're not getting decent quality products or services at mm-hmm. a reasonable price.
The problem is they're getting decent quality.
Right. Great quality. I mean, right. the services are amazing.
Yeah.
And never mind, it's free.
Right.
So, like, now, when I was learning economics at university, we had this notion of predatory pricing, mm-hmm. which is when you price your product
right.
below marginal cost in order to you know, to cut out the competition, and that was seen as a problem. Well, now, I mean, predatory pricing is the business model, right, which is we give it away free.
And because they know the right prices to hit. I was literally at a dinner with the head of Walmart the other day, and he's like, God, their pricing at Amazon is so hard to follow. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, they were the low price leaders, and of course, yes, they have to chase it really fast.
So I think that we've got to broaden the focus.
You have a company like Amazon, if you're talking about communities, that nobody shops anymore. Or you have Facebook, nobody goes to church anymore. Nobody, Google, you find things. Like, it's all separate.
Well, there's two questions. There's the, the way that it's all united is we've got to broaden it out. We're not just consumers.
Mm-hmm.
We're workers, and we're family members, and we're community members, mm-hmm, and we're citizens who vote in elections. You know, we're not just consumers. So the idea that regulatory framework is just on, are you getting good stuff at cheap prices, is
right,
so out of date.
What's going to happen there? What do you see?
Well, what I'm arguing for, mm-hmm, and actually, you know, recently had a really constructive conversation with the former head of, mm-hmm, the FTC about it, and I don't think this is now outlandish at all, this, mm-hmm, this direction of travel, is to broaden that definition. So it's not just, and the specific proposal I've got in the book, again, this probably, mm-hmm, really is one of the sacrificial prototypes, mm-hmm, is we've got to move away from the regulation of antitrust on the basis of the whim of an individual regulator or a, mm-hmm, court, a judge in a case, and actually have some rules here. And the framework that I propose is based on market power, or market concentration, which is over a certain proportion of a market, you're deemed to be a monopoly, and you're and basically part of the public sector.
Right.
So you can't pay
your... You become a utility.
Yes. And you, for example, you have maximum pay rates for a senior executive, mm-hmm, minimum pay for workers, tight regulation on how you behave, a little bit lower, I don't know, between 10 and 40%
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, that's never passing.
Hold on a second. You're deemed to be dominant, and you have slightly less regulation, and let's say you're under 10% of a market, then you're totally competitive, and then maybe there's an incentive to do that where you have no regulation or whatever, mm-hmm, you know. But and of course, as I say, people argue about where are the right levels and so on. But and it sort of depends how you define it. You know, if you define Amazon as a retailer, it's quite a small percentage. Online retailer, very big. Book retailer, kind of total monopoly, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those things will
it's
be
difficult.
Argued.
That's it's difficult. The whole thing. You can't pin anything on them as
yes,
easily.
Yes, but I think let's just start the conversation and try and get a bit more granular about it. I think that but there is an issue. The issues about tech addiction, as mm-hmm, it were, I think that is less amenable to this kind of concentration of power argument, because
no,
even if you had 1,000 Facebooks, mm-hmm, all with incredibly addictive, mm-hmm, technology, you'd still have that problem.
Right.
And so I think, I mean, you know, my solution to it is not to use a phone at all.
Yes,
and I've not had a phone for 6 years. That's extreme.
Right.
But I think that the future, I mean, you know this far better than I do, but as the devices are kind of disappearing and the tech is kind of merging, mm-hmm, more into
your body. Yeah.
I don't, in a weird way, that might make it better.
Right.
I don't know.
Except if it's all pervasive.
Yes, but it means you're not literally looking at a screen.
Right.
I don't know. I can't tell how seriously they're taking it, frankly. I think that I was,
ooh,
you know,
the tech
again,
companies
massive,
are regulated.
Well, the tech companies. I mean, I say massive, you know, like disclosure, as you mentioned, mm-hmm, one of the, my wife currently is at Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But so you can, you know, dismiss this if you like. But I think it's interesting that in the last year or so, Mark Zuckerberg has started to talk thoughtfully,
mm-hmm,
about, you know, using this phrase "time well spent," which, mm-hmm, came from Tristan Harris,
the
design ethicist, yeah, you know, ethicist who's trying to help the companies do this better. That seems to me a serious engagement with the issue. At least they're not just blowing it off. I don't know. I mean, I'm really
it's
I'm not.
Bullshit.
Okay, well, that's your view, but
I know it's bullshit.
I think that the funnily enough, I did, in my past life, I ran this company, Good Business, in the, mm-hmm, UK. And one of the, and we were a corporate responsibility consulting firm, we worked, mm-hmm, with big companies. Mm-hmm. And this issue came up a lot in other contexts, particularly utility. We had some utility companies who were being obliged by the government to promote energy efficiency.
I think people are.
And so the question we always, it came up quite a lot, and McDonald's was one of our, mm-hmm, clients and so on. And it was like, well, how do you make a virtue of trying to get your consumers to use your product less? How do you actually make that?
Oh, look at Patagonia. There's a bunch of companies.
Yes,
I would say
it's not impossible.
There are tech leaders. I think Kevin Systrom was one of them.
Interesting.
You know, very much so.
Uh-huh.
We've talked about this stuff a lot. He's the only one who ever would engage with me on these topics,
right,
years ago. Dwayne Chesky. There's a couple that really, I would say Mark Benioff, when he's not being Mark Benioff, is very much so. There's a lot. It's just a question of whether they see it as not just a duty, like take your medicine, and more as this is an ethos.
And also, what we tried to argue at Good Business, and I wrote a book called Good Business, Your World Needs You, is like, try and see your social contribution as core. So it's not the sort of add-on and as you say, the guilt. It's like, can you think of a way
14.
To genuinely benefit commercially from helping to solve social problems rather than create them?
Absolutely. And one of the things I always say is
either you
do something about this or you buy yourself a Mercedes that is weaponized. You're going to have walls, and you're going to have you know what I mean? And then the populism we don't like so much, the ugly populism, will be dangerous for
people. Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, for example, we talked earlier about the predatory price, giving it away free. Mm-hmm. If you start charging, I don't know, I don't want to do the job for them, but I think there must be creative. It's this combination of thinking about it, but you've got to get commercial about it. Otherwise, it will never be serious. You've
Absolutely.
Got to rethink 100%, the business
model. 100%. All right, just finishing up, last thing. What will happen to Trump populism in the next election? And very quickly, because we've got 1 minute.
Midterms?
Midterms and going forward.
It feels very much as if the backlash to Trump's election will be the dominant focus, and particularly with the mobilization of women candidates and women voters in response to a combination of both sides, Trump's victory and Hillary Clinton's defeat. That feels like the story of this particular election.
Does the ugly populism peter out, as it often does?
No, I think that's why it's very important that, I mean, I'm serious about trying to turn this into a movement so that we put something against that that's constructive and positive.
Right.
Because I don't think it's going away, because I think the problems are getting worse. Mm-hmm. Precisely because there isn't a policy agenda to deal with the concentration of power and we haven't talked about immigration, but I think that the mass migration around the world, this is a bigger and bigger issue, and conflicts around the world leading to displacement of people and refugees.
It's interesting,
because
it does strike me, and then we have to finish, is a lot sometimes when Trump says things, he's directionally correct and has a lizard brain for the right thing, but always is focused on the wrong thing. Like with tech companies, like they're conservative bias. I'm like, no, they're not. They're like, but there is concentration, but there is a problem over there.
Yeah.
But he's always identifying the exact wrong problem. You know what I mean? Exactly the wrong problem. And then over here, they're doing the real damage.
I think one thing I would say is that he's absolutely right about China. I mean, we haven't got time to probably get into that, but I do think that that's a real shift in policy from where you saw the consensus in the foreign policy establishment, which is like, if you suck up to China, engage with them, whatever, they're going to get better on human rights, they're going to become more of a market economy, it's going to be absolutely, totally wrong.
I'm on that side too.
Yeah, exactly.
But not the way he's doing it. Like, I'm like, what are you doing?
Well,
it's not about plastic toys. It's
correct. But, there is sign that, I agree, but there is sign that there's sort of, the regime, which looks so powerful and vulnerable, even a year ago, there are little signs of it wobbling a bit, actually, and saying, hang on a second.
I think they're racing right past us. I think we're focusing on their plastic toys, and they're busy innovating the future of AI and everything else.
Well, that's why we've got to both impede them from doing that and support our own efforts.
We're focusing on the plastic toys. That's over.
I think that he may be in one sense, but I don't think the policy generally. I think that there's smart people in there who actually get the broader picture.
Yes, absolutely. All right, Steve, this is great. Your book is called Positive Populism. It's available now on Amazon.
I'm going to say this. I paid for a site called positivepopulism.org, which also enables you to buy on Barnes & Noble and independent retailers
so on. Good. Well, you should read it. Steve's a really thoughtful person in Silicon Valley, and it's always nice to have him and talk about these issues. They're very important ones going forward for the whole country, and we do have to move in a positive way. And you do sound a little lefty now. I don't know what's happened. You've been hanging out in Palo Alto too long.
No, it's Fox News. It's turned me left.
That's right. Okay, the left wing of Fox.
No,
right,
I'm
here
joking.
We are.
I don't like I think the left-right thing.
I hate it.
I don't
Everybody
buy it
hates
at all.
It. Yeah. They're exhausting. They're more exhausting on the right now, but they're exhausting on all sides. Anyway, it was great talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show. If you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find more episodes of Recode Decode on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You just want to say hi, tweet at me. I'm at Kara Swisher on Twitter. Steve, where can people follow you online? Nowhere, right?
I do tweet at Steve Hilton X.
Okay, at Steve Hilton X, and at this popular
positive populism.org.
positivepopulism.org. And also you can go look at Crown Peck. He's not involved anymore, but it really is an interesting company that he started. Now that you're done with this, go check out the latest episode of Recode Media. You can find that show wherever you found this one. Thank you for listening to this episode of Recode Decode. Thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Saturday. Tune in then.